But when you are, Sarge... Robbie was stunned. Callie Protheroe was beautiful. She looked as if she should be sashaying down a catwalk rather than picking her way through decaying ruins. He was rather glad that Marie was doing most of the talking, as he had been rendered speechless. "Please don't feel bad about what happened last night," Marie said. "It wasn't your fault. We're just glad you've chosen to come forward." "I don't know," Callie said. "If I'd been thinking straight, I would have rung you immediately. I knew there was someone else in that hotel, and if I'd taken the rumors of Urbex's going missing more seriously, I could have prevented what happened." She shook her head. "I'm so sorry. I'm a fool." "Just tell us everything you remember, no matter how insignificant it seems." "So far, you're the only person who's been able to tell us anything at all," said Marie gently. "Well, I did take his car number."
Robbie found his voice.
"You saw his car?" "It was an old Vauxhall Astra, DC Milton. I think it was a dark red or maroon color. It was hard to tell in torchlight."
She handed him a slip of paper with the registration number written on it.
"That is old. Looks like a 1990-91 plate," said Marie. "Can't be too many of those knocking around anymore. And he just left it parked outside?" "Inside the gates, out of sight of the road. It wasn't there when I arrived, so he must have followed me into the hotel. I'd parked a little way away and walked in, so he probably never saw my vehicle and wasn't expecting me to be there."
"And you didn't even catch a glimpse of this person? Just heard footsteps?" Robbie inquired.
"Just footsteps. And as I told Will Sheringham, I'm certain they were a man's. They were heavy and purposeful."
"You must have been absolutely terrified," Marie said. Callie smiled for the first time. Robbie thought she was probably the most beautiful girl he had ever seen.
"Not really. Well, not initially. As an urban explorer, you spend quite a lot of time avoiding other people, like security guards and sometimes, although rarely, police officers."
She grinned.
"Usually it's other urbexes who have infiltrated at the same time, but that's fine. At first I was more puzzled than anything. I decided to get my shots and then split. After a while it started to creep me out, so I packed up early and found a fire escape. I did hang around after I got outside and I took a few exterior shots. That's when I found his car."
Robbie was amazed at how cool-headed she had been. Most women, men too, would have freaked out given the location and the fact that it was night.
"It wasn't until after I got home that I started to wonder if I'd had a lucky escape."
Callie opened a document wallet that she had brought in with her.
"Tell me what you think of some of these photographs."
She carefully laid them out on the desk.
"They don't show whoever was in there, but I swear they caught something of the atmosphere that night."
Robbie hoped that the ever-pragmatic Marie wouldn't make one of her usual no-nonsense comments, but she laid them all out and looked carefully from one to another.
"You took these?" she exclaimed.
Callie nodded.
"Photography is my passion. I'm always looking for the perfect shot." "They are amazing. They're so professional, so beautiful." She paused. "Although, you see it too," said Callie. "Menace."
Robbie leaned forward, surprised at Marie's choice of word. Then he saw it for himself.
"You're right," he said quietly. "You've captured a sense of fear, haven't you?"
"I'm not sure now whether it came from me or the situation," Callie shrugged.
"Then I wondered if I was imagining things."
"No," Marie pointed to one.
"That shot has me looking into the shadows, trying to see what might be lurking there. It's quite remarkable, Callie. And as my colleague here will tell you, I'm usually about as down to earth as they come."
This was not completely true. Robbie was aware that Marie's mother, Rhiannon, was meant to have something like second sight, especially regarding her daughter. Even though she denied it, Marie often knew things instinctively. She called it policeman's nose, and said it came from years of experience, but Robbie wasn't so sure. He believed she'd been born with it. When he wanted to tease her, he called her the daughter of a Welsh witch. He picked up the photo that Marie had been referring to. It looked along a corridor and into an open room, which must have been a function room of some sort. What had been the rear wall of the room was a dark, tangled mass of trees and burnt timbers and a sinister night sky. Almost made him shiver. Marie had indeed used the right word. The room oozed menace. Robbie wanted to turn around and run back down that corridor and get as far away from the place as possible.
Can we copy these, Callie? We'll let you have them back, of course, and they'll only be used for this inquiry, I promise.
Marie was still looking through them.
Keep these, dear Sevens. I printed them for you.
The smile had gone now.
I feel I need to do whatever I can to help, considering that I should have come forward earlier.
Did you know the two lads who went out last night, Kelly? Asked Robbie. Grant Leach and Ron Morley. She shook her head.
Not well. I met them once.
Ron has posted comments and likes when I've shared an image on one of our websites, but that's all. Marie leaned forward.
And you always infiltrate and explore on your own, with no company or backup in case of emergency.
Mostly. I prefer it that way. I always leave the details of where I'm going with Henry Arnott, a friend who would come out if I needed him.
But you didn't phone him the other night, Marie stated.
Callie sighed.
I didn't think I needed to. I thought it was just me being spooked. Frankly, D.S. Evans, I felt stupid. I didn't even tell Henry about what I suspected when I sent him a home safe text. I told myself I was being foolish.
Understandable, said Robbie. He showed Callie a statement form that he'd been making notes on while they were speaking.
Now, if you would just read this through, and if you agree with it, sign at the top and bottom.
He looked at her.
You've been incredibly helpful, and we do appreciate it.
Callie read the statement carefully.
That's all correct. Where did you say I should sign?
Robbie leaned across and pointed. As he did so, he caught a hint of her perfume. He swallowed. He was in a steady relationship. He shouldn't be feeling like this. He sat back, filled with confusion.
We'll give you our cards, Callie, and please don't hesitate to ring if you remember anything else.
Or if you hear something on your network that you think we should know about, added Marie.
And please assure anyone that we are on your side. We only want to find out what happened to these three missing men and to keep you all safe. We aren't about to start lecturing you on trespass or anything, she smiled. Well, not this time.
She handed Callie her card.
Day or night, Callie, I mean it.
Robbie fished around in his pocket and found one of his own.
That goes for me too.
They walked Callie to the front door. As soon as it closed behind her, Marie turned on him.
Robbie Melton, what was that all about?
Well, all he found to say was a lame,
she's very beautiful, isn't she?
Her eyebrows shot up.
Should I remind you that you have a perfectly gorgeous girl of your own?
Probably not, but
no buts, detective, Marie said sternly. Jeez, you are practically dribbling.
Robbie groaned. Marie exploded in peals of laughter.
Get a grip, Melton. You fall in love far too easily. Now, back to the investigation, if you can recall what it's about.
She marched off down the corridor. Robbie, trailing in her wake, could hear her chuckling to herself as she went. All he hoped was that Callie Prothero hadn't picked up on it, too. Chapter 12 Jackman had just spent over an hour with Ruth Crook. He'd hurried off to see her, believing that she had more news of Orak. To his surprise, what she wanted to discuss had nothing to do with their missing IT chief.
The thing is, Ruin, you are not the only one trying to take Kirby off the streets.
He had frowned. He had been busy drawing together all the loose ends in the case of the money launderer, Brian Kirby. Another week, and he would have enough to pass it to the CPS.
It appears that your man has been busy, although this time on the streets of London. The Met have been watching him for some time, and they want him for much more serious fraud offences than the ones he's committed here in the Fens.
She had looked at him hopefully.
We have two options, and I'm hoping you'll choose the one I've opted for. We can work with them, giving them complete access to everything we have, and also allowing them to take the lead, or, she looked at him intently, we can hand over everything you have and give them carte blanche to bring the investigation to a conclusion.
They will get the kudos, of course, but Kirby will go away for considerably longer.
Jackman opened his mouth to answer, but she hadn't finished.
Option one will mean having two Met officers temporarily working out of Salton, with you as their liaison. They are very anxious that our smaller inquiry doesn't jeopardize their chances of getting him for the big stuff. Option two, we miss out, shut up shop on the work you've already done, and walk away from it.
Jackman frowned.
Bottom line,
There's a good chance Kirby goes to prison either way, but if his empire is growing, I'd let the Met have him, Ruth. The more years he gets, the better. I'm not going to be precious about this case. They can have it. Option two is my choice.
Ruth nodded. Then option two it is. They'll be pleased with that decision, Rowan, as am I.
I'll contact them and get the ball rolling. They had then begun the process of collating the information Jackman had already accrued, and how he should prepare the reports for handover. That done, Jackman grinned at her.
To be honest, Ruth, they're welcome to it. It's been one of the most boring cases I've had in years.
Ah, you're getting too used to murder most foul, my friend. Sultan has been home to too many evil souls over the last few years. You should welcome the dull and boring investigations. They're far less dangerous, and equally less vexing to the spirit.
She was right.
Probably. And I have to say, not having to look over my shoulder or feel threatened from morning until night has its appeal.
The team looked positively rejuvenated.
I had noticed the lack of haggard expressions, including when I look in the mirror, Ruth nodded. It's like a terrible weight has lifted, and that includes the gold breed. Apart from this concern over Orak, my commanding officers are mightily relieved.
She sighed.
And that makes my life considerably less stressful.
Well, I think a couple of days' work should see me ready to wave goodbye to Mr. Brian Kirby,
Jackman said.
Will they come here to pick it up, or will everything be sent electronically?
You'll get a visit later today, I should think, so stay around. They'll tell you what procedure to follow.
She looked across her desk at him.
Thank you, Rowan. I believe that's the right decision. Now, what have you got lined up next?
Jackman told her about the young man who'd disappeared from an abandoned building on the outskirts of Sultan.
I'm going to request complete disclosure, Ruth. From both Greenborough and Fenchester, I want us to have this case. He looked at her eagerly. Sort of a reward, if you like, for giving up Kirby.
She shrugged. Sounds fair enough to me, and since they're little more than missing persons cases to the other two sections, I can't see anyone objecting.
Use your usual tact, and I'm sure they'll be glad to hand it over.
Jackman wasn't quite so certain, but at this point he decided not to mention Fenchester's odd behaviour regarding Randleby Airfield. Clearly Ruth knew nothing about it.
Excellent. So, if that's all, Ruth, I'll go and make a start on wrapping up Kirby.
Fine, off you go. And I'll give the Met the good news.
How nice it was, thought Jackman, to see Ruth Crook smile again. It hadn't ever happened often. It wasn't her way, but today she must have smiled about 4 or 5 times. So, along with losing the Kirby case, things were going well.
Marie was wondering why a beautiful young woman like Callie Protheroe would want to spend her nights alone, exploring dangerous old wrecks of buildings, when she heard a cough.
A civilian was standing at her desk.
DC Evans, a letter has arrived for you.
The young man handed her an envelope with a printed address label.
She stared at the letter, wondering who could be writing to her at work.
Though it was a local postmark, she suddenly had a premonition that it had to do with Orak. She tore it open and read the single sheet of paper.
Marie, go to my locker in the IT department. The key is wrapped in a handkerchief in the stationery tray on my workstation. Take what you find there and wait for my call, Orak.
She glanced at Jackman's office, but the door was still closed.
Okay, she'd tell him later.
She folded up the note and pushed it into her pocket. Orak must have posted it just before she left town, so her disappearance had to have been carefully planned, and she hadn't been forced to flee.
But why?
The IT department was oddly quiet. A couple of technicians were head down, working in the back office, but there was no sign of Leon, David, or Philip, which was fortunate. Marie went over to Orak's workstation and slid open the top drawer, which was divided into compartments that held pens, staples, and other assorted stationery. The small key nestled next to some memory sticks and a pack of AA batteries. Glancing around to check she wasn't being watched, she took the key and then made her way to the department restroom. One wall was lined with 6 tin lockers. 2 were open and empty, so that left 4 to try. Marie held her breath, hoping no one would come in. She guessed that this was something Orak wanted kept between the two of them. The second locker opened easily, and she immediately saw exactly what she was supposed to take. The locker was empty, save for a cheap mobile phone and a charger. Marie picked it up and pocketed it, hurriedly locked the door again and left the room. No one even looked up as she left the department. Back in the CID room, she sank down into her chair and let out a sigh of relief. That had gone surprisingly well. Now, all she had to do was wait. Easier said than done. She should be concentrating on the missing Urbexes, but all she could think about was Orak. Marie glanced up and saw Jackman making his way along the corridor to his office, a smile on his face. She stood up. Apart from needing to tell him about the mobile phone, that smile needed investigating. People rarely emerged from Ruth's office looking so cheerful. He told her what had been said. "That's the result, Jackman? The bad guy goes to prison and you are spared all the paperwork and the court case that would no doubt have dragged on for months?"
"Well, I might have to appear, depending on what they charge him with. But basically, yes, it's a result.
The main thing is that Kirby is stopped and I'm not too worried about who gets to slap the cuffs on him."
"Generous, sir. Very generous." She grinned at him. "Although, I've an idea your decision might have been swayed by the thought of having two Met detectives camped out in your office for weeks on end. Or am I barking up totally the wrong tree?"
Jackman gave her an angelic smile. "My decision was entirely altruistic, Marie. How could you possibly think otherwise?" Marie raised an eyebrow.
"So, I was right. Thought so."
She told him about the more serious matter of Orak and took the mobile phone from her pocket.
"Sit down," said Jackman. "This throws a slightly different light on things, doesn't it?"
Marie sat down.
"That's what I thought. We might not have been correct in our assumption that she took off suddenly. To buy a phone and leave it for me to find, then get a letter into the post, it all smacks of forward planning."
She drew in a breath.
"Then again, she could have had some inkling about what was going to happen and prepared this," she pointed to the phone, "just in case she had to move fast."
"That's possible," Jackman said. "Now you're going to be on tenterhooks until the damn thing rings."
"Too right. I'm already watching it like a hawk. It's not good for the nerves, you know."
He pushed it across the desk to her.
"Keep it close. She'll contact you when it's safe to do so. Meanwhile, I have Ruth's go-ahead to join in the Urbex investigation. So, before I buckle down and start preparing for the Kirby case handover, I'm going to ring both Greenborough and Fenchester and give them the heads up."
Marie got to her feet.
"I'm eager to see what our Gary finds out from his pub crawl around the Randleby area. That, and what in Orak's absence our Max has managed to find on the internet about that airfield."
"That's a point, isn't it?" said Jackman. "If Orak were here, we'd know every detail in a matter of hours. I'm told her team are now rushed off their feet trying to keep up with everything. So I don't like to ask for their help just yet. As you say, Max is good. Let's hope he can find something."
An image of that old motorbike rose in her mind like a banner, signaling to her.
"I so need to know who's responsible for that place."
"And who to ask about a certain old military Norton, or so the grapevine tells me." The good humor was back.
"Maybe," she said casually.
"I'd say definitely. You get this dreamy look every time you think about it."
"Well, it's such a waste, sir. I know a bloke who'd give his eye teeth to have a go at restoring something like that. It belongs somewhere it'll be cherished, not stuck under a bloody bench and rusting into the ground. And that aviation centre, the one where they do the Lancaster bomber taxi runs on the runway, I bet they'd bite my hand off for it."
"Okay, Marie, you win," said Jackman.
"As soon as I'm through here and have packed Kirby off with the Met boys, I'll do a bit of digging myself and we'll try to salvage your old machine."
"Oh, there you are, then. I'm going to hold you to that, sir."
Even she realized that her Welsh accent had come to the fore, and they both laughed. As she left the office, it hit her that no one in CID had laughed properly for a very long time. It felt good. There were two decent pubs in the Randleby area, but the first had thrown up nothing of interest. In fact, the landlord, who appeared to be having a bad day, was far from helpful. The second, the Golden Compass, was just a mile away from the airfield, and was Gary's best bet. He went up to the bar and was about to order a drink when a voice called out,
"As I live and breathe, Gary Pritchard!"
He knew the voice immediately, even though he hadn't seen its owner for many years.
"John Beard, well, I'm blowed. How are you?"
John Beard was tall, with a ruddy face and a mop of curly grey hair. He was dressed for the country with a wax jacket and sturdy boots.
"It's damn good to see you, Gary. It's been far too long.
He clapped Gary on the shoulder.
What are you having?
Half of best bitter, please, John. Have to take it easy, I'm driving.
And I'm on duty, he added to himself. Still, he needed to look the part, and an orange juice wouldn't hack it.
What are you doing in these parts? Harlan Marsh is your area.
It was. Moved here 2 years back. Nice little village property. Half a mile from the pub. What more could you want?
Better and better, thought Gary. He had met Beard through Gary's late sister. She and John's wife had been good friends and had spent a fair bit of time together, walking their dogs and helping out at the local church. After his sister died and he moved to Sultan-le-Fen, he and John had lost touch.
"Still in the police?"
John asked, setting his beer down in front of him.
"For my sins, yes, and I'm really enjoying where I am now."
"Nowhere could be worse than Harlan Marsh. God, that place was a dump. My wife used to tell me how unhappy you were there. They had a major shake-up, didn't they? And you transferred out."
Gary nodded.
"I'm with a great team now, the best."
"Glad to hear it. You're a good copper, you deserve it."
John beamed at him.
"I retired early after my Nancy had a bit of a windfall. She got left an old aunt's place in Surrey. She sold it and we found ourselves quids in, so we decided to move here and live the good life while we can still enjoy it."
Gary had always liked John Beard, and was very happy to meet up with him again. But he did have a job to do. The great thing was, John was totally trustworthy. The man had been a customs and excise officer until a car crash had prevented him from doing his job, and he'd left and taken a civilian desk job with the police in Fenchester. Gary sipped his beer and decided to take John into his confidence. There was a chance that this unexpected meeting could turn out to be hugely beneficial to the case, especially given his connection with the Fenchester station.
"Let's sit down," Gary suggested, pointing to a quiet table in the far corner of the room.
He lowered his voice.
"I'm actually on duty, and I think you might be able to help me."
The glint in John's eye told Gary that early retirement was already beginning to pall somewhat.
"Okay, mate, spill the beans."
Gary gave him an abbreviated version of the story.
"We believe that the old airfield has a history that for some reason no one wants the world to know about. We've been warned off by Fenchester Station, and so has one of the Fenchester officers."
"Who would that be?" asked John.
"D.S. Ralph Enderby. He was trying to assist us and got hauled upstairs."
"Ralph? Blimey. He's a top bloke, Gary. I can't imagine anyone having to tick him off."
"And another detective, a chap called Mick Holliday, seems to have been brainwashed into deflecting all inquiries about Randleby Airfield. He's been telling anyone who asks about the missing kid a whole load of bull."
Gary sipped his beer.
"Something isn't right, and I need to find out what that airfield is all about. You live here now, John. Have you heard anything? Any local rumours?"
John was silent for a while.
"Funnily enough, I've been wondering about that place myself. As you know, my work with customs took me all over, and to all sorts of locations where we suspected smuggling was going on. Randleby wasn't on any of our lists of airstrips, so I was quite shocked to find it a mile from the place I'd just moved to. It seems to be completely unknown."
Gary leaned closer.
"What do you make of it? Civil or military?"
"Military, without a doubt. But why isn't it on the list of decommissioned sites?"
John shook his head.
"I took the dog out there one day, just walked the perimeter, and there were men out there checking the fences. Now, I could be wrong, but they looked official, if you get them adrift. But why be so careful about a place that's not been used for aeons?"
"Why, indeed," said Gary.
"And another thing, I went to a gathering at the parish church over at Scamble. That's a village just a couple of mile away. There was a display in the church of wartime memorabilia and photographs of this area of the fens. Now, I could have been mistaken, but I'd swear I saw the tail of a military plane in one of the old photos. And not only that, there were other pictures of the area where the airfield is, and I'm dead certain the layout has changed.
Maybe they sold some of the land off to local farmers after the war," suggested Gary.
John shook his head.
"No. The thing is, it's not smaller now. It's bigger. What was once an adjacent field is now within the fenced-off perimeter."
This is getting odder by the minute, Gary muttered. Do you reckon you could make a few inquiries for me, on the quiet? Nothing to get yourself noticed. Maybe a word or two with a few of the older residents who might remember something.
Sure. I'll give it a try. I'll start with a historian who puts on the photographic display. He's well known for talking the tail off a donkey where local history is concerned.
John laughed.
It'll cost you a couple of pints, mind you, if I'm to have my ear bent for half an hour.
It'll be worth it, mate. I might even throw in some pork scratchings. Now, can I get you another? Gary asked.
No, thanks, Garrett. My Nancy will be expecting me back for lunch. I'll tell her we've met up again. She'll be delighted.
He lowered his voice.
She was devastated when your sister died. She never really got over it. They were really good friends. Nancy still misses her.
She's not alone, believe me. I miss her every day of my life. Give Nancy my best, and here's my number.
He handed John his card. John Beard took out his mobile and tapped in the number.
Gotcha. I'll ring you, and then you'll have mine.
Gary left, feeling that the day had been worthwhile, both for the investigation and for him. He didn't have a lot of friends outside the team, and John, despite being older, had always been good company. A laugh when you needed one, and a good listener. In Gary's opinion, John would have made a pretty good detective. He had an inquiring mind, a shrewd intelligence, and even better, he knew the officers at Fenchester. They might just open up to an old colleague.
Yep, it had been a good day.
Chapter 13. Robbie was just about to call Stella when his desk phone rang.
It's PC Vander Rogers from Eastfleet Manor. PC Ian Little told us that we should contact you directly if we found anything.
Robbie leaned forward. And have you?
What appears to be the site of a scuffle. We've cordoned it off and a socko is heading there now. I thought you might like to come over and check it out.
Thanks, Vander. I'm on my way. See you in around 15 minutes.
Robbie grabbed his jacket from the back of his chair.
Max, would you tell the Sarge I've had to go over to Eastfleet Manor? And would you also ask her to ring Stella and see if we can visit her sometime this afternoon? Oh, and Lisa and Will Sheringham too. Got it, mate. See you soon.
The old hotel no longer seemed so menacing in the bright light of day. As he was locking his car, Robbie saw Vander waving to him, and he hurried over. Then the socko, wearing a blue hooded coverall, looked up too.
It was Ella,
smiling at him from behind her mask. For a brief moment he felt guilty, as if he and Callie Prothero had been conducting an affair. Telling himself he was making far too much of a few words with an attractive woman, he smiled at his girlfriend.
Morning again. What have we got?
He stood behind the small square, cordoned off with blue and white police tape, while Ella pointed to the ground.
Two distinct sets of footprints.
She indicated the bushes lining the drive. Branches that have been recently broken, and grass that's been trodden underfoot. The frost earlier this morning has left us some nice clear prints. Robbie frowned. So the attacker was waiting in the bushes and jumped Grant Leach on his way back to the tripod.
Looks that way, Ella said. But I need to know what make of shoes the other explorer was wearing, so as to eliminate any footprints he might have left.
Robbie called Ron Morley.
Ron? Robbie Mountain here. We need the shoes you were wearing last night for forensic examination. Any chance you could drop them off at the station today?
Ron said that he would. And I can tell you exactly what shoes Grant was wearing if it helps. He leaves all his Urbex stuff with me, and he always wears one of two identical pairs, the canvas walking shoes.
That's brilliant, Ron. Have you got the other set?
Yeah, and they have quite a distinctive tread. I'll bring them with me. Robbie repeated what Ron had said to Ella.
That makes life much easier. If you can identify what the Urbexers were wearing, we're left with your abductor.
Have you been inside the hotel yet? Robbie asked.
Not yet, she said. Creepy old place, isn't it? Is there anything you are looking for in particular?
Robbie nodded. We believe the person who may have taken Grant was in the hotel doing a reconnaissance a few nights ago. Another explorer was here taking photographs, and she thinks she heard them. An image of Callie's lithe figure rose into his mind. Robbie dismissed it.
If you could, we'd like more footprint pictures, so we can eliminate that explorer as well. No problem, as long as there aren't too many different sets. Ella smiled. I'll get onto that as soon as I've finished here. She looked into his eyes. Better get on, Robbie. I'm up to my neck today.
And I'd better get back to the station. I need to keep moving on this. This makes 3 disappearances, and I'm beginning to worry about how many more there'll be.
I'll ring you later this afternoon, and hopefully get some images to you.
We'd really appreciate it, Ella. Oh, and any luck with that piece of glass I gave you earlier?
Prof Wilkinson himself is checking it out. He's pretty sure it's a lens from a torch. I'll let you know about that too.
She gave him a smile.
See you tonight.
He winked at her. For sure.
What on earth had he been thinking? Ella was gorgeous, and he was lucky to have her.
He really should get a grip. Even Marie had noticed the way he looked at Kelly. If the mess room got hold of it, they'd have a field day, and then it would get back to Ella. He'd have to get Marie to deal with Kelly Prothero in future.
While Robbie was out, Marie had been liaising with Uniform regarding Grant Leach's parents.
Though anxious not to alarm them unduly, the team had to be sure that Grant hadn't returned home late the previous night. Like the other missing Urbexes, he wasn't answering his phone, and his family were growing more anxious by the hour.
Marie had just rung Stella and arranged to visit her that afternoon when she saw 2 men in smart suits being escorted into Jackman's office. The Met obviously hadn't wasted any time in coming to claim the Kirby case. She smiled. Jackman would be delighted, and he wasn't the only one. She looked forward to his input on these strange disappearances. The more she thought about it, the more she believed they had a predator, someone who was targeting urban explorers. Lisa and Will Sheringham were convinced that this was the case. But why?
Sarge?
It was Gary Pritchard.
Hope you can still walk in a straight line, she said. Or was it a really good pub crawl?
Sober as a judge, and there was only one pub that was any use.
Gary told her about his chance meeting with his old friend John.
My sister, Anne, and John's wife, Nancy, were inseparable, and I trust him. If he can help us, he will, he frowned. That airfield had been bothering him, too. He swears it was military. I wonder what's going on there.
Maybe Max will be able to tell us more. He's been on the phone for an hour, and I reckon his keyboard is ready to ignite. He's been hammering away on it all morning.
Well, I bet he gets nowhere, said Gary flatly. I have a feeling there's some kind of government cover-up to do with that place.
Marie knew that kind of thing happened, but having visited the place and found it to be a boring, miserable piece of land with a crumbling tower, a few empty and decrepit hangars and stores on it, a cover-up didn't make sense.
But there's nothing to cover up, Gary. It's just a useless chunk of flat ground.
Nevertheless, something about it stinks, said Gary flatly. Why maintain the perimeter fences so carefully if there's nothing there to protect?
You're right. All I can think about is that lovely old bike rotting away under a workbench, said Marie sadly. I need to get it out of there.
Gary smiled.
Oh, what it is to have a passion.
She grinned at him.
I know, I'm an anorak where bikes are concerned.
Like those urban explorers, said Gary. I guess it starts when we're kids. We all have it, don't we? The urge to slip through that hole in the fence, peek through the windows of the local haunted house. I know I was desperately inquisitive as a child. Maybe it never goes away in some people.
Like Cali Prothero, thought Marie. If you added that childlike curiosity to her determination to capture the perfect photograph, then you had a woman who would happily explore a strange building alone at night. Marie thought of her own love of fast motorcycles. Perhaps they weren't so different after all.
Blimey, you two look deep in thought, Max said. Where are you both?
I'm riding my bike along a moonlit fen lane, thank you, said Marie.
And I'm trying to crawl into Mr. Watkins' barn without tearing my school trousers, said Gary wistfully. Happy days.
Of course, Max nodded sagely. Should I call the men in white coats now or later?
Marie smiled at him.
It's all right, Max. We haven't really lost our marbles. Believe it or not, it's loosely related to the case.
Very loosely, I'd say. Max didn't look convinced. But if I could drag you back to the real world for a moment, this bloody airfield is a closed book. I've decided I'm wasting precious time on it. If Orak were here, it would be different. She has ways and means that aren't available to me.
Told you, said Gary.
It's a whitewash, a cover-up for some reason, at a very high level.
I think you're right, Max said. As soon as Rob gets back, I'll tell him it's a dead end. I'll need to be working on these people who have gone missing, not chasing rainbows.
Agreed, said Marie. And then the phone rang, the one Orak had left for her. Marie jumped up, muttering, Excuse me, fellas, I need to take this, and hurried out into the corridor. It was a great relief to hear Orak's voice.
Are you safe? Asked Marie at once.
For now, yes, Marie. I'm sorry for all this deception, but I had to go. I hope you understand.
Your sister? Chanced Marie.
My sister, Grania, yes.
Have you found out what happened to her?
I have a good idea. Today, I met with a woman who remembered everything from back then. She has given me the name of a contact, another woman, who could be the key to it all. At least I now know that my dear sister didn't die on that fateful night. She was abducted for a reason.
She sounded excited, almost elated, which was not like Orak at all.
Marie could understand why.
It's been so long, Orak. I hope you get the news you want, but please go carefully. Jackman and I know more about you now, and we are terribly concerned for your safety.
I knew the risk before I embarked on this, Marie, but thank you for caring.
Is there anything we can do? Anything practical? Marie asked.
I'll text you if there is, I promise. I have to find my sister, but I will be back, Orak assured her.
By the way, does anyone know about the mobile phone?
Just Jackman, and I'll need to tell Ruth, but she is behind you on this all the way.
I know. Ruth is a good woman, even if a little terse.
She gave a characteristic dry chuckle.
That's very true, Marie said, smiling to herself.
I have to go, Marie, but I'll be in touch. Feel free to keep Ruth updated. I know it won't go any farther.
Take care.
The call ended, leaving Marie almost trembling with relief and desperate to give Jackman the news. She would have to wait until he was free of his Met colleagues before she could do that. She returned to the CID room and found that Robbie was back, looking pretty cheerful.
We have clear indications of a scuffle outside the hotel. Ron Morley has just brought in a pair of walking shoes that are identical to the ones Grant was wearing. I've sent them directly to forensics.
He opened the gallery on his phone and showed her the shot of the footprints. The tread had a very distinctive pattern that resembled pointed leaf shapes.
I've not seen any like that before, Marie said. It will certainly help us to trace Grant's movements.
Ella's onto it now, so by this afternoon we'll hopefully have an idea of exactly what occurred. Robbie flopped down into his chair.
So, what's been happening while I was out?
While they were telling him, a civilian brought in a memo.
DC Milton, uniform traced the vehicle that was seen out at East Fleet Manor. It's registered to a Mr. Edward Carter at an address in Hull. The problem is, he died a month ago, apparently, and since he was something of a loner, no one realized that his old car wasn't at his property. Footage from traffic cameras is being checked to try and spot it on the local roads, but the sergeant isn't hopeful.
Robbie took the memo and thanked the bearer.
Another dead end.
You can bet your bottom dollar that car has already gone through a crusher, said Gary, or it'll be found burnt out somewhere on the fens.
I'd still get Humberside Police to check it further, advised Marie. Our stalker might have a connection to this Mr. Carter or to Hull.
It's a long shot, but it needs following up. Shall I give them a call?
Robbie nodded. Please, Sarge, if you would.
Then it would be time to go and see Stella. I said we'd be there around 2:30.
I'll grab a sandwich and a coffee then.
Robbie looked at the other two.
Would you both do a search for everything you can find out about Grant Leach?
You got it, said Max. It'll make a change from looking for non-existent airfields.
He lay back on his bed and concentrated on his breathing. He had been meditating since his late teens as a way to escape the world and calm his thoughts. He wouldn't be going out tonight. He'd given himself a free day to recoup and get some well-earned rest and relaxation. He had worked out for an hour, taken a shower, and was now clearing his mind. Besides physical strength, his task required a cool head. He had known it wouldn't be easy, that the psychological side of it would trouble him most, but he was utterly committed to it. Finally, his head clear of troublesome thoughts, he sat up slowly. Today he would set aside all plans, eat well, sleep well, and go for a long walk along the sea bank. Today was his day. Time enough to resume his mission tomorrow. Everything was in place, and God willing, the next operation would go as smoothly as the ones before. He allowed himself a moment to think of them. He was now over halfway there. Three debts had been settled, and those three irresponsible explorers were safely ensconced in one of the places they had spent their lives trying to infiltrate. Only this time, they weren't getting out. Chapter 14. Professor Rory Wilkinson, Home Office pathologist, wore a satisfied smile.
"Result," he said to himself as he replaced the receiver, "and I don't feel the slightest bit guilty about pulling strings to get it."
For some time now, his chief technician, Spike, had been carving a niche for himself as a specialist in forensic ballistics. Trouble was, this threatened to take him away from his beloved Fens. Spike had been what Rory called a slow burner. In other words, he had shown little promise. However, over the last 2 years he had turned a corner, making himself practically indispensable to Rory. In the process, he had developed a keen interest in the area of ballistic trauma and gunshot wound trajectory analysis. Rory encouraged him on his chosen path, but at the same time, he was reluctant to lose him. The perfect foil for Rory's offbeat sense of humour, Spike had become a trusted and well-liked colleague. However, the lab and the morgue needed to function smoothly, and they couldn't do that while his number two was being constantly called away to conferences or seminars. So, Rory had requested help, which had arrived in the form of Cardiff Erin. Erin Rees had embarked on a career in archaeology, but then changed tack and decided to give forensics a go. This exacting science had soon become her life's work and true passion. Erin was proudly Cardiff-born, prone to expressing herself in Wenglish, a hybrid of English and Welsh, along with Welshisms, phrases only ever heard in Wales. He had taken to her immediately, and more remarkably, she quickly developed an understanding with her unconventional boss. Now he had the best of both worlds. Spike was to remain in Greenborough, still working at his side when available, and his new protégé, whom he had dubbed Cardiff, was to be his permanent number two. Perfect.
"Some boxes have arrived for you, Prof. One of the lab technicians had his head around the door. They're labelled personal."
Rory rarely had anything personal delivered to the morgue, so, curious, he went to check them out. Two sturdy brown cardboard boxes stood on the reception desk. They had been posted in Peterborough and bore no return address. All their lab supplies were delivered by courier or directly from the supply companies. He hadn't ordered anything online. Rory eyed them suspiciously. Reminding himself that all incoming packages were screened, he lifted one up. It wasn't particularly heavy. With a muttered, "Here goes," he opened it up, to find a neatly packed brown paper parcel tied with string. He laid it on the reception desk and untied it. He found himself staring down at a carefully folded pile of clothes, most definitely a man's, including jacket and shoes, and a bulky manila envelope. Leaving them on the desk, he called his lab.
"Cardiff, can you come up to reception immediately, please, and bring a camera, a couple of large paper evidence sheets and some gloves?"
While he waited, he tried to recall what this reminded him of. Then it came to him. It looked like the official return of personal possessions after a death, especially a military one. Erin Rees appeared and handed him a pair of sterile gloves.
"Prof, what's occurring?"
"I'm not sure, Cardiff, dear, but I have an idea we should proceed with caution. Photos, please. Take the box itself and this parcel, and then get pictures of every item as I lift it onto the evidence sheets."
He laid the sheets down on the floor. Then, very carefully, he took each item of clothing and placed it on a sheet. He opened the envelope. It contained a leather belt, a wristwatch, a mobile phone, a small transparent packet containing a single gold ear stud, and a wallet. The last item was a folded sheet of paper. After Cardiff had photographed it, Rory read it out.
"Name, Aaron Smith. Date of birth, 03/04/2001. Status, single. Address, Little Grebe Cottage, Saltacre Lane, Finchester O'Dyke. Occupation,
trainee engineer with Seymour and Sons of Finchester.
Cardiff shook her head. Oh dear, that sounds like...
I know exactly what it sounds like, Cardiff.
He took his phone from his pocket.
That's why I'm calling D.I. Jackman.
In just over half an hour, Marie and Gary were at the lab.
Jackman apologizes, Rory, but he's tied up with an investigation handover, said Marie, staring at the clothes and belongings spread out on the evidence sheets. You haven't opened the second box yet?
Rory tilted his head.
Left that for you, dear heart, because I suspect you know exactly what you're going to find, don't you?
Anthony Hood, she said solemnly.
I thought you'd know.
We've already photographed this lot. Rory indicated the objects on the floor. Now I'll get some of my team to start going through them. However, from the scent of lavender that assailed my nostrils when I opened the box, I surmise they've all been laundered and treated to a hefty dose of fabric conditioner.
Handy, having them delivered directly to the forensic lab, isn't it? I mean, a bit too handy, if you ask me, said Gary, with a puzzled expression on his face.
Marie had thought the same. Not only that, how did this person know who to send it to? Even down to his name.
If he keeps this up, you'll be getting another one soon, Professor. Effects belonging to Grant Leach.
While we get the other box down to the lab, Rory said, you can tell me about this mysterious purveyor of freshly laundered clothes.
Actually, Rory, we know nothing at all about this man, Murray said, assuming it is a man, that is. Those clothes indicate a very bleak outlook for the men who went missing. Until now, we had no idea what had happened to them. There was always an outside chance that they had run away or something, but now... Her voice trailed off.
As you say, the outlook is pretty depressing, but you never know.
Rory patted her shoulder.
Once, many years ago, a similar thing happened, though I wasn't involved. In that case, the parents of four missing teenagers were sent their children's clothes and other sundry items, and we all feared the worst. However, he paused for effect, in fact, they had been kidnapped and recruited into a cult which forbade everything modern. They were forced to wear simple uniform tunics and pants. All their possessions were returned to their parents, along with a note asking them not to try to find them, that they were happy and were now part of a new family.
All crap, of course. They had been abducted and brainwashed.
But luckily we managed to lift enough forensic evidence from their clothes to be able to locate the place where they were being held.
I heard about that case, Professor, said Gary. It was over Market Deeping Way, wasn't it?
That's right. Around 15 youngsters were finally returned to their families, all thanks to developments in forensic science. He pulled a face. Although, I get the feeling that this man won't have left too many traces in his little present.
He set down the unopened box on an examining table.
Right, let's see what we've got this time. Cardiff, over here with that camera, please.
They made their way to the lab, where Rory took his time, cutting through the tape with a scalpel and leaving the rest intact in case any residue had been left on the adhesive.
Oh, we do love sticky tape, he crooned. It attracts all kinds of remnants, especially skin cells and hairs.
He raised the lid to reveal another brown paper package. Rory lifted it out and laid it on the table. Denim jeans, a black T-shirt, a hooded sweatshirt with a logo on it, underwear, socks, and a many-pocketed gilet. A pair of walking shoes and a bulky manila envelope rested on top. The clothes matched those Lisa Sheringham had said Tony Hood was wearing on the night he went missing.
Would you open the envelope, please? Marie asked. Only I've been told Anthony Hood had a wristwatch of a very particular design, a black skeleton with scarlet hands and a black link strap.
Rory took out a mobile phone, a signet ring, and an unusual-looking black industrial watch with red hands. He looked at it closely.
Goes by the name of Weird Ape, a Yorkshire company, I believe. Inventive original designs.
That's it? That's Anthony's watch?
Marie sighed, despondent. No longer were they investigating a slightly oddball mystery. They were after a killer. Rory opened the note.
Name, Anthony Francis Hood. Date of birth, 11/07/1993. Status, single. Address, 14 Culpeper Avenue, Fleet Seas End, near Greenborough. Occupation, transport manager for the Anglo Plant Company, Greenborough.
He sniffed the air.
Lavender again. And all the clothes neat and clean, ironed as well by the look of them.
He peered closer.
I am very well, actually. Even I'd be proud of that job. Look at that T-shirt. Not a crease anywhere, other than the folds. If he wasn't clearly deranged, I'd ask him if he was looking for a job. My David's a stickler for immaculate clothes. He'd pay good money for a home help with these skills.
Murray giggled. Rory was good at lightening the mood.
I'll ask him when we catch him, shall I?
Maybe. Let's wait and see what he's actually done first. On second thoughts, I'm not sure I'd want him in my utility room wielding my steam iron.
Best that way, added Gary dryly. He's probably very strong.
Why is that? Asked Rory. Marie spent the next 10 minutes giving Rory the whole story.
Ah, so that's the glass fragment Ella Jarvis gave me. I see now. And it's all to do with this case that's sending her trotting around taking pictures of decrepit old ruins. She was at some burnt-out hotel this morning, I believe.
That's the place young Grant Leach disappeared from last night, Rory. I expect you'll be getting a box of his things in a day or so. Marie sighed again.
I'll let you know immediately they arrive, and I'll try and fast-track it for you. I've had a spate of rather sad natural deaths recently that have kept me busy, but hopefully we've seen the last of those for a while, so I'll be able to get back to these more interesting cases.
As Murray and Gary prepared to leave, Rory said, Before you go, I received a message via the ever-efficient grapevine regarding your nemesis, Alistair Ashcroft. My dear one, I cannot tell you how thrilled I am about his new home. For once, justice really did prevail. The culture shock he's probably suffering couldn't happen to a more deserving fellow. He squeezed her arm. You must be feeling so relieved, Marie.
Beyond words, Rory. We're all feeling the same way. It's like a massive weight has lifted from our shoulders and we can breathe again.
I know what you mean. And after you find Laundry Man, life will be complete. On their way back to the station, Gary rang and told Robbie what they had found.
I've already got a list of what Grant was wearing from Ron Morley, said Robbie. And if Rory gets another delivery, we have a pair of identical shoes, so there will be no difficulty confirming whose clothes they are. Oh, and can you tell Marie I've postponed our visit to Stella until later this afternoon, and Lisa and Will until tomorrow?
It's okay. I'll put the call on speaker. We're only 10 minutes away, so we'll fill you in when we get back.
Gary ended the call and sat in silence. Finally, he said,
Why do that? Why return all their things? And why send them to the forensics laboratory? It doesn't make sense.
Marie had no answer. It was all so organized. Everything about these disappearances seemed to have been planned in meticulous detail. The men so quickly and silently taken from the abandoned buildings, and culminating in those neatly pressed clothes arriving in tidy bundles.
You're right, Gary, it doesn't make sense. But it obviously makes perfect sense to whoever is orchestrating these disappearances. This whole thing is being carried out like a military operation. But what was his motive?
As soon as Jackman is free of the Kirby case, we need to have a serious brainstorming session.
The sooner the better, Sarge. I'm starting to get a bad feeling.
You're not the only one, Gary.
He smiled at her.
Would one of Gary Pritchard's famous steak and ale pies be of any help? I've got one ready for tonight's dinner, and there's far too much for one.
Marie returned his smile.
My hero. There's nothing I'd like more, Gary.
Marie had been to Stella and Tom Chalk's converted barn before. It was the perfect setting for the two former urban explorers. They had spent years inside magnificent, unusual buildings, and now they lived in one, although this one wasn't decaying.
We're having sleepless nights over this, Tom said, handing around mugs of tea.
That's right, added Stella with a sigh. Who on earth would go after urbexes? I mean, they're just inquisitive young people with a taste for history who want to record it before it disappears. They do no harm.
Not everyone thinks that way, though, said Marie. A whole lot of people, and that includes a lot of police officers, would view them as trespassers, and people with no respect for other people's property. They equate them with vandals and graffiti artists, unless they are shown to the contrary. I mean, before I saw all the amazing photos and talked to you guys, it seemed madness to me to go crawling around filthy, dangerous, abandoned buildings.
Tom laughed.
Huh, very true. It's a popular misconception, but thinking about reasons, we wondered if it was someone who had chosen urban explorers for no other reason than that they are vulnerable, suggested Tom. They frequent places where few other people go. There is little chance of being caught in a dark, uninhabited building, is there?
Possibly, said Robbie, with a glance at Marie.
"It's a thought, all right," she said. "But it seems to me that it's too deliberate. Plus, there was always someone else there when he took his victims."
"Yes," said Stella.
"On reflection, we thought the same. It was much more likely that those men were specifically targeted.
Have you found any connection at all between them? Other than their shared hobby, that is."
Stella obviously had her old copper's hat on.
"Not yet, Stella," Marie said. "So far, we haven't had time to delve into Grant Leach's life. But Anthony and Aaron are very different, and we can't find any links between them."
"We asked Ray Zakara and Emily Butters, and they can't shed any light on it either. They don't think Aaron ever even knew Tony Hood, other than by reputation. They're still talking to other explorers, but nothing has emerged so far."
Stella took a sip of her tea.
"They're still feeling responsible for young Aaron's disappearance. Emily in particular is on a crusade. She's determined to get this guy, whoever he is."
Marie didn't like the sound of that.
"Tried to dissuade her, Stella. She should leave it to us. She could get herself into trouble."
"Believe me," Stella said. "We've both warned her off, but she's not listening."
"Well, if she tries anything that worries you, tell us, and I'll have a quiet word."
The last thing they needed was a young woman charging in and finding herself in mortal danger. "Hang on. What if he has a list?" said Tom suddenly. "It's been bothering me ever since you told Stella that Callie Protheroe was in that hotel alone with the stalker, and he let her go."
"Why? Because she wasn't on his list."
He looked from Robbie to Marie. This was exactly what Marie had been wondering.
"I'm inclined to agree. That's why we are desperately trying to find a link between these guys. But what could they have done to get on his list? There has to be a reason," said Robbie. "If it's not connected to who they are, it has to be where, a particular abandoned building that they've all explored and maybe inadvertently damaged in some way. Some kind of shrine? Somewhere that means something to the stalker? And that they violated in some way?"
Stella volunteered.
"Hey, good thinking," said Robbie enthusiastically. "That's a new avenue for us to take, isn't it, Marie?"
"It is."
Marie's mind was going into overdrive.
"Just their presence could be enough to send a deranged mind into killing mode." She paused.
"Do you guys keep diaries of your expeditions?"
"Most do, though often in the form of photo albums. Some we share, others we keep to ourselves. Stella has a massive photo library of her explorations, don't you, sweetheart?"
"Written records, too," she added.
"I'd say it's definitely worth checking their computers and their homes for both of those. That's one of the reasons we do what we do, to record and share, or at least record before those places are destroyed, either by man or nature."
"So, if we can pinpoint a particular place they have all been to, maybe somewhere not well known, we might just have a lead," said Robbie excitedly.
"Slow down, Tiger," said Stella with a grin. "There are very few lesser-known places left these days. You'll need help from people in the know. We've been out of the loop for a while now, so I'd suggest either Will and Lisa Sheringham or Ray and Emily."
"But it's a real possibility," said Robbie, undeterred. "We'll definitely get some of your Urbex friends in on this line of inquiry."
"I think Lisa and Will are your best bet, Robbie," said Marie. "Will lives on the internet, so he probably picks up all the chat about who's going out and where, and Lisa explores all the time."
"And she's not as emotionally involved as Emily," she thought to herself.
"I agree," added Stella. "Talk to Lisa and Will."
"We'll be seeing them tomorrow. We got held up and it's too late to go today."
Marie checked the time.
"Speaking of which, we should get back. And Stella, do your best to warn Emily off, won't you?"
"Of course," said Stella. "Although I can't promise it'll do any good. She can be a headstrong little mare."
"Stella looks good, doesn't she?"
Marie said on the drive back. "I can't remember when I've seen her so happy. Well, not since she was still at work and nicking the bad guys," Robbie said. "And Tom's a great bloke. I like him a lot. He's good for Stella, keeps her feet on the ground, but doesn't hold her back. Not easy with a vibrant, enthusiastic woman like her."
"Her injuries are hardly noticeable now," Marie said.
Besides her other injuries, Stella had suffered brain damage. Two bullets had torn into her, one in the head and one in her side. The physical wounds had healed well, but she had been left mentally impaired. Over time, and with the help of her adoring grandmother, Beth,
and Beth's partner, Michael, she had got her life back. All that was noticeable now was a slight tremor in her hand, the occasional loss of balance and sometimes of concentration. Her life as she had known it had been blown apart that day. The journey back had been rough, but she had pulled through, and now she was both happy and pregnant. Marie dragged her mind back to Tom's suggestion.
"I've been thinking."
Robbie looked at her expectantly. "And?"
"If Tom's right about the Urbexes finding his special place and him taking revenge on them, that special place must have enormous significance for him. So what could turn an abandoned building into somewhere sacred?"
"Could be anything, I guess," said Robbie. "Where he met the love of his life, the place that once belonged to his family, where he lost his virginity." Marie laughed.
"I know that last thing is pretty significant, but even so, I'm not sure it's worth murdering people for."
"Okay, I'm clutching at straws. What do you think?"
"Something a little darker. What if he wanted to make sure they never went back because he had hidden a body there?"
"Oh, right. As dark as that," Robbie exhaled. "If it was the final resting place of someone he loved, maybe someone he'd even killed accidentally, then he would be sincerely pissed off if groups of kids started trampling all over it.
Or he simply didn't want the body to be discovered and killed the Urbexes to save his own skin."
Marie turned this idea over in her mind, and by the time they were parking the car at the station, she had convinced herself that she was right.
Chapter 15.
Aurac had expected Summerhayes Court to be an old rambling place, but for a retirement village with a nursing home attached, it was very modern. She found a large single-story complex comprising a main block surrounded by neat bungalows and chalets. She reported to reception and was told that Mrs. O'Leary was in one of the smaller chalet homes, number 12, in Cedar Grove. As she walked across the car park and headed in the direction the receptionist had indicated, she grew increasingly and uncharacteristically nervous. This was the closest she had come to finding out what had happened to her sister after she was taken. There was no guarantee that this woman would be able or willing to talk to her, but she was the only lead Aurac had. According to her informant, Clodagh O'Leary knew more than anyone about little Grania's abduction. She had then added, rather enigmatically, that sufficient time had passed for Clodagh to let go of her secrets. Orla Kraken looked nothing like young Kira O'Dwyer, as she had been then, but as she stood with her hand on the doorbell, she looked nothing like Orla Kraken either. This woman, wearing denim jeans, a roll-neck sweater, and an old, well-worn wax jacket, had dark shoulder-length hair, and thanks to a new pair of lenses, brown eyes. Clodagh O'Leary opened the door and stared at her. For a moment, neither woman spoke. Aurac had the odd feeling that Clodagh knew exactly who she was and why she was there.
"I wonder if you'd have time to talk to me?"
Aurac asked, without introducing herself.
Clodagh hesitated. Then she held the door open and led the way into a small, comfortable living area. This was bizarre. For all Mrs. O'Leary knew, she could be selling something, insurance or religion.
She sat in an armchair, one of a matching pair. Clodagh O'Leary lowered her thin body into the other, exhaled loudly and said,
"I've always wondered if one day," she paused, "if one day someone would come."
Aurac closed her eyes briefly. So she did know.
"Can you help me find my sister? I've been looking for over 20 years.
Her voice faltered.
"I don't know if I can, my dear. I have no idea where she is, but I can tell you what happened. It's time this was finally shared."
Aurac looked at her, both desperate and full of hope. She saw a woman who was far too thin, whose hair was red and wispy, and had a flat look to it, as if every drop of moisture had been leached away. Her clothes were clean but old-fashioned and starting to wear. The woman crossed herself.
"I didn't want to meet my guard without speaking out. What happened has been weighing heavily on me for some time, and I believe that your coming was ordained."
A faint smile ghosted across her narrow lips.
"I'll make some tea, shall I?"
"That would be nice." Orak watched her make it, her slow, deliberate movements, and wondered if she was playing for time and what she was thinking. Would she feel absolved, or would she feel all the more guilty for keeping it to herself for so many years? Having placed tea in a china cup and saucer on a small table in front of her guest, Clodagh sat down again. She winced with pain, and Orak realized that she was ill. Maybe that's why she had spoken about meeting her maker.
"First, you have to understand that no malice was intended when that child, your sister, was taken. It was done at a time of terrible confusion and madness, and for a long time no one knew about it."
Orak leaned forward. "I want to know everything, all of it. But first, please tell me, is she still alive?"
"Until 2 years ago, when I last saw her, she was very much alive, Miss O'Dwyer. It is Miss O'Dwyer, isn't it?"
"Yes. I'm Kara."
"I thought so. There is something about you, although I have no idea what."
She picked up her cup in two shaky hands.
"She looks a little like you."
Orak wanted to laugh and cry. Grania was alive. She had Dara to thank for this, the man who had sent her that first lead. As soon as she got back to England, she would contact him. Maybe they could meet up again. They hadn't seen each other for many years, but he had never stopped helping her in her search for her sister.
"Dara, I'm forever in your debt. I'll pay you back somehow." "It was my sister-in-law who stole your sister from her bed. We believed she was in the psychiatric hospital at Ballydonal, but she had run away. She took the child and passed her off as her own. It seemed she had been planning it for months."
Orak tried to recall the family, but she had been too young.
"Why was your sister-in-law in a psychiatric hospital, Clodagh?"
The old lady looked down at her hands.
"Her own child died in tragic circumstances, and it sent her over the edge. She refused to believe that the baby was dead."
She shuddered.
"I remember it as if it were yesterday. She was mad with grief. She acted as if the child was still there, making food for her, washing her clean clothes over and over again. And the conversations she had with the dead girl, oh, it turned your stomach and broke your heart."
Orak tried to take this in. Everyone had assumed it was a man that had taken the child and subsequently killed her. Orak suspected that even her parents had believed the worst. Only she had refused to give up on Grania.
"We never knew. You have to believe that, Kira. We searched for 3 days along with every other family in the village. We were truly devastated."
Clodagh's voice trembled.
"Then we got the news that Mairead had disappeared from the hospital, and she became the focus of our attention."
"They didn't notify you immediately?" asked Orak. "Why not?" Clodagh gave a sad laugh.
"Things